I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
At any given time, there are probably no more than a couple of dozen people who are known to the planet by first name only. It feels like that should be an honor that the world decides to grant to somebody. But it's not. It's the result of a singular person wresting that name away from everyone else, making a surname unnecessary by sheer force of personality or will or excellence or notoriety, or all four of those, like Kobe.
Bryant attacking. All the way, dunks it home! Kobe down the middle with the phone!
Find Kobe. And Kobe will get it for the win.
The LA Lakers, the 2010 NBA champions!
And Bryant, loving the feeling of being a five-time champ.
Even people who are known by only one name during their lifetime are humans, though they might seem like legends. That means that they aren't perfect, but it also means that they're not the same person forever. They might be frozen in one place, in our minds and our memories, but that's us, it's not them. Even as people like Kobe exist in this strange pantheon, they're still changing and still evolving. Their story is still being written. Or at least it should be. But the other side of the human behind the legend is that that means they are ultimately just as frail as the rest of us. And that, too, is a reminder that no matter where any of us think we are in the long story of our lives, there's always a chance that without knowing it, we are writing the final chapter.
Why did you decide to write this book about a girl playing tennis?
Well, I have four girls at home, and I want to make sure it's important that they, see characters that look like them.
And the Oscar goes to Dear Basketball, Glenn Key and Kobe!
Everything I learned came from Kobe. Everything. Take Kobe away, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have love. I wouldn't have the passion, the drive. No, everything came from me.
So make that chapter count, like Kobe. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Donovan Bennett of Sportsnet, someone we usually talk to at happier times in the sporting world. Hello, Donovan.
Hello. I'm here once again. Not a feel-good story, unfortunately.
No. But why don't you start, because you've been covering basketball and probably been a fan of basketball a lot longer. What's your first memory of hearing the name Kobe?
I mean, my first memory, I guess, would be like Kobe and Brandy going to the prom together. Like, that's how young, literally, he was when he became a one-name person, right?
Yeah.
Kobe and Brandy, one of the biggest female pop stars, R&B singers in the world, and Kobe, right? A still flourishing basketball player, but he wasn't yet an all-star, an all-time great, but he was already a celebrity. And even the myth of him started early. There was talks about him in the draft process having this amazing workout that Jerry West, someone who's not big on hyperbole, kind of saying, listen, I haven't seen anything like this. Hmm. And especially a kid coming out of high school at the time, and almost basically wanting to stop the workout immediately just because he didn't want it to get out how well it was going, and in a way trying to tank, Kobe's value. And the trade that happens between Charlotte and the Lakers, and Kobe basically saying, I don't want to be a Hornet, because he knew the Lakers were in on him and he wanted to be a Laker. He had seen their games on tape delay growing up in Italy, where his dad was playing as a pro.
It's part of the mythos of him that he wanted Hollywood.
Yeah.
Right from the beginning.
From a very young age, right? And this was before we saw high school mixtapes of players on Instagram, and we knew what a force Zion Williamson or RJ Barrett or even LeBron James were, mm-hmm. right? This was really like all you're hearing is just rumors and innuendo, and there wasn't really great footage. And so he, for good and for bad, ushered in this wave of players coming straight out of high school, so much so that later we had to course correct and say, well, no, we can't have these players coming from high school as readily because they're all not Kobe Bryant. And Kobe, in a way, became almost like a bigger brother to those young guys.
Yeah.
Tracy McGrady talked about the fact that he would go out and stay at his house in LA and they would train together. And we'll get into it in this conversation. And he is a fully formed, complex person. Like, I think when we look at celebrities, we look at them in this linear way on a timeline. Mm-hmm. Just look at their Wikipedia page. They did this, they did this, they did this, and then they died. End of story. Where they're complex. And Kobe, when you think about him, you think of fierce competitor, wanting to do everything to win. And that doesn't really compute with him being a mentor, being someone who's willing to give his time. Now, some of that might have been ego, just the fact that, oh, I love that people are coming to me as the resource of how to get better in basketball. But certainly he was a reference point for players in his generation, for players after his generation. And I think that is a big part to me of his legacy.
What happened on Sunday? Tell me about the crash, first of all, but the hours following that when there were a whole bunch of stories out there and nobody seemed to know exactly what had happened and what was going on around the league at that time.
I think why it hit so hard, one of the reasons, is because of how and when it happened. So Sunday, I mean, theoretically, that's like a family day on the weekend. Middle of the day Sunday anyways. I was literally with my family having brunch with my brother and my mother and my young son, and I just got home. And I'm getting texts from my brother blowing up my phone. And I was like, I literally just saw you. What could be so urgent? And this is something that happens in our time. I don't know if it happens to you, but it certainly happens to me. When you get a text with just someone's name, you automatically think the worst. You think either death or some sort of scandal.
Yeah.
And sadly, in this case, it was the first one. It was death. And my brother was trying to verify that Kobe had actually died, as if I was going to be able to tell him. But just at that moment, you're looking for any sort of reason to say, hopefully this is not true. And so someone who worked in sports, naturally, the text came to me. And then as soon as you go online and you see that TMZ's reporting it, I kind of just assume at this point that it's real and it's probably true. When they broke Michael Jackson first before anyone else, I was like, all right, they're kind of undefeated at this. And then it's just the news of, well, who else was there? Was Vanessa there? Were his kids there? Was it five people? Was it nine people? Was Rick Fox there? Was something that was happening on the internet. And so that whole part of it is uncomfortable because you're hearing different people confirm things that are conflicting. So someone's wrong.
Yeah.
You don't want to jump to any conclusions. But at the same point, I'm thinking weird if I'm rooting that Gigi, his 13-year-old daughter, is not on the chopper, because then I'm just hoping that someone else that I don't know is.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole thing, from the coverage to how the information was disseminated slowly throughout the afternoon, made me feel uncomfortable and made me feel sad that, you know, one of the greatest players of all time, you know, his last memory will be trending for the wrong reason.
Tell me about the reaction around the NBA as the news broke yesterday. There were games being played just tipping off like an hour later.
Yeah, and this was another part of the debate that was going online and the reporting that was being done was whether or not they were going to play the games and the conversations that were being had at the league office level. And the tricky part, again, is because since the information was so raw and was tough to verify, it's tough as a league to make a decision. And
I was watching the timeline. And so the news started breaking on Twitter. I don't know when TMZ found out, but it started breaking on Twitter around 2:20, 2:30. Raptors and Spurs were set to tee off at 4 p.m. Eastern. So there was about 90 minutes in there.
Yeah, and CNN was talking about a crash but not naming a name, and then they named a name. And so you're not really sure at what point would you pivot. I actually think they should have played the games. I might be alone in that thought for an entirely different reason. And, you know, in a way, the precedent that it sets. If you don't play the game for Kobe, where do you draw that line of, okay, well, you're not as important. You're not as influential. Mm-hmm. You didn't make as big of an impression on the basketball world. So we can still play in light of your death.
I think or you didn't die in a tragic enough manner, right? Correct. You passed away after a long illness, so we're not stopping the game.
Yeah, I mean, David Stern sadly passed away a couple weeks ago, and he was older and was not the active commissioner and was in a tough health situation for a little while, so people had prepped for it, but he still died. He still had a massive impact on the game, and so I felt that it was handled well and that the teams, in credit to the Raptors who had the first possession and Kyle Lowry dribbling out the clock to honor Kobe and his 24, taking a 24-second violation, and then Greg Popovich instructed his team to do the same. I thought they handled it beautifully, and the Atlanta Hawks did it with their own spin. I thought the league handled it beautifully, and I suppose it would be different if the Lakers had to play. Kobe was a figure that was bigger than basketball, bigger than sport.
Why was he bigger than sports? And here I want you to talk a little bit about how he played the game. And I don't mean his basketball X's and O's, but it was the spirit of what he did that everybody from people like Alicia Keys to tennis players and other athletes discussed yesterday.
Yeah, so he was divisive at the best of times. And I think even history will look back at the way he played now that we look at the game differently and think divisively on how good he actually was. But no matter if you liked him or disliked him, for the most part, people respected him as a sportsman, as an athlete, as a competitor. And we all have this internal conversation in our heads. How far am I going to push myself? How desperate do I want to achieve greatness, whatever that looks like in your life or whatever? There was no doubt that Kobe was willing to push himself much harder and much further than everyone else. I mean, the Mamba mentality is a colloquial phrase that people use outside of him or even basketball. And I think that's why he's universally respected, because how tough he was mentally. He talked about the fact that the reason why he had the confidence and swagger to take shots at the end of games without conflict is because he knew that he worked harder than anyone else to have that honor. His mental toughness, the fact that he tore his Achilles and took the foul shots and made them both in a close game and then walked off the court, not knowing if those were going to be the last shots ever. Mm-hmm. Mentally, he was at a different level. And that I think that's why no matter if you are in the sports arena or outside of it, you can see that and project it into your own life and your own endeavors and really respect it.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
One of the conversations yesterday, certainly on social media, but also I think just as people talked, was how should people remembering him discuss the period in time when he was accused of sexual assault and was going back and forth from Lakers games to Eagle, Colorado, and was eventually settled. But that was in a different era. And now we take victims a lot more seriously than perhaps we had in the past. And, you know, I'm asking this because I wanted to do this podcast to talk about him as a human being, as opposed to the one-name person that we put on a pedestal and remember for all their legacy and growing the game and everything. And I think Kobe's life itself changed multiple times, and this was a part of it. So why shouldn't we talk about it?
When he talked about it, it wasn't his, I'm sure, favorite topic, but in the documentary about himself that he produced, A Very Kobe Thing, but directed by by Gautam Chopra, there's a section in it, there's a chapter where he discusses this chapter, literally, of his life. And he doesn't name the situation, he doesn't name the place, but you know what he's talking about. But he does talk in great detail on the impact it had on him and his family. And here's the part of it that I struggle with. Because you're right, that we are in a different era. And so we are looking back at something that happened in the early 2000s with a 2020 lens.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a big part of our current culture that says we need to believe victims. It's very important to believe victims in order for them to be able to grow and heal and process, but also for other women and men who are sexual abuse survivors to know that if they speak out, they will be believed. And so we need to normalize the conversation, and that's important. And certainly that's a part of the Kobe conversation. But there's also another part of our conversation that we've always had that we've understood as a culture, innocent until proven guilty. And that we give someone, when accused, the benefit of the doubt, given our judicial system, which is not perfect, but that's the best one that we have. And so how do you reconcile those two things at the same time? I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Because on every piece of content that's put out about Kobe, there are going to be people who say he is a rapist, he is a sexual abuser. And there are going to be people who say, if you bring that up, that is unfair given what just happened. And there might be some truth to both. I know this. I know that, and it's odd to phrase it at best, but at best, he was someone who stepped out in his marriage, which is not great. Sadly, it's something that happens all of the time. And at worst, he is guilty of a heinous crime. And what we're also learning about the Me Too conversation is that there's also a murky middle. There's also a middle where consent is not fully given or consent changes in the middle of an act. And so in Kobe's own apology to the victim and to his family, he himself admitted at the time that after watching the victim's testimony and looking at the discovery during the case, he understood that what he believed to be consent was not what the victim believed to be consent. Those are Kobe's words. Those are not mine. And so certainly it's something that needs to be part of his conversation because it did happen. He himself said he had a daughter at the time and his wife was pregnant with a child on the way. Sadly, his wife miscarried during this period of time.
I didn't know that.
He blames himself for it. He said that the stress of the coverage and the trial put his wife through the edge. No, also sadly, women miscarry more often than we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And so no matter if that's actually the real reason, he felt it was. And that during his relationship, when she could have left and took half of the money, and literally, when he got back, it was a waiting to exhale scene where she threw all of his clothes into the street and he had to live elsewhere for a period of time. His narrative, both as a family person, as a basketball player, could have totally changed. And would I like to believe that that situation, no matter where on the spectrum things actually happened, if it was just infidelity or if it was a crime, would I like to believe that he grew a great deal from it? I hope so. I wasn't in room 35 in Eagle, Colorado. I don't know what happened. But I do know that in the last chapter of his career, he was an incredible champion for females, for women in sport, for women in our industry. And so, again, he's a complex character with good and bad traits. And I think it's probably disrespectful to him and everyone around him to act as if a big part of his life just didn't happen.
I'm glad that you said it that way and put it on a timeline, because one of the things we wanted to do is talk about him as a full person in the full spectrum of his life. And I mean, it's pretty clear that in the latter half of his career, he was a different person, if not a different player, and he was moving towards being an elder statesman for the league, and as you mentioned earlier, having so many of those younger players under his wing and showing them the ropes. How does that jive with the early career impressions of Kobe Bryant versus how he was seen by his peers as he was finishing his career?
You hit the nail on the head. He was a different player and a different person. And I wonder if the fact that he was a different player informed him being a different person. When you look at him coming into the league, so athletically gifted, his jovialness and the way he played the game was part of his mystique. It's part of the reason why he was on Sprite commercials and, you know, why he had this side rapping career. The thought of late Kobe Bryant all day filming a rap music video just seems so far removed from who he was, because everything was consumed with the work, was consumed with the basketball, because he lost some of that athleticism due to injury, just due to age. He lost some of that bounce. So then he had to be a craftsman, a masterclass in footwork, in angles, in just repetition and getting shot up after shot up after shot up, and had to use his superiority mentally as the thing that separated him, because he no longer had the superiority physically. And that's how I'll remember him at the end of his career. And so, tragically, that helicopter, the chopper that was made famous, he ended up using it, not because he could or because he was a celebrity. He used it because it was a competitive advantage. Anyone who's been to LA knows how wide the landscape is, and, you know, their practice facility is in El Segundo, but their arena is downtown in Staples, and he lived in different parts in Orange County, and his Mamba athletic facility, the academy, is in 1,000 Oaks.
You'd lose a lot of time to horrible LA traffic.
Yes, and LA is so big, and there are so many different communities amongst to themselves, and he used the chopper as a way to save time, to save his body sitting in a limo for hours on end, and in the back end of his career, to gain more time with his family. And so his level of ingenuity on figuring out a different way to do things that others weren't willing to do, and his level of willing to be efficient and compete at everything, is one of the many ways I'll remember him. And sadly, that chopper, that competitive advantage that he had, it's the last place that he was.
Tell me about the final chapter that I guess we never really saw the ending to. A lot of people looked at Kobe like they did at Michael Jordan or so many other famous athletes as somebody who would be unable to walk away from the game and who would not be able to quit, not be able to take himself apart. And I mean, it was kind of a surprising ending to watch him do just the opposite of that.
Yeah, I thought he would be one of the many athletes that struggled in retirement and just went crazy. And he actually said to media, you won't find me at Staples Center. Like, why would I go from Orange County to downtown to watch other people play basketball? That's not how I was built. And in fact, you ended up seeing him at Staples Center quite a bit. And it was to expose his young daughter, who tragically passed with him, to the game, because she was a lover of basketball. And he would tell media that from an early age that she had the same kind of will and mentality that he did. And so big part of his next chapter was, you know, being her coach, being a mentor for other female basketball players. Sabrina Ionescu was the most recent of many female NCAA players that he would shout out on social media, that he would work with one-on-one and send them tips. That happened to NBA players in the league that were much younger than him. Kyrie Irving, Isaiah Thomas, they all kind of went to the church of Kobe to learn about different things in his game. And then there's obviously the guys who grew up in California, like DeMar DeRozan and Norm Powell, who he was icons to them. And he had the Mamba Academy, that facility, to teach people about not just basketball, but training and getting the most out of yourself. And he wins an Oscar with Dear Basketball, which is just a poem that he wrote to say goodbye to the game. It ends up becoming a short film and winning an Oscar. So now, not only does he have, you know, Larry as a gold trophy, he has Oscar as well. And he's written a bunch of children's books. He's started a children's podcast, to use basketball as a tool to teach them. There's this entire side of him that I never knew existed, never thought I would see. But that really, when you think about it, when you take a step back, it makes sense, because his upbringing was so different than the traditional NBA player or athlete. We've heard so many of the same story. Young guy, impoverished neighborhood, often from a single parent family, uses that pressure to force themselves to become an athlete. That wasn't the case for Kobe. His father was a professional player. He lived in Italy. He speaks multiple languages. He's well-read. He lived in Philadelphia, but in a well-off neighborhood, but had to go to the bad neighborhoods to get some great basketball competition. And so in a way, he was always a bit of an outsider. He never really fit in. And in Italy, he was this tall, you know, black kid. In the United States, he was this well-versed kid that dressed a little bit different, had different musical tastes. And even in the NBA, he was a relic to the older past before him, but he never fit in with the AAU mentality of everyone was buddy-buddy and friends, and they would create super teams. He was always, I guess, on an island in a way. And I think Malcolm Gladwell has talked about this. When you're an outsider, it gives you an amazing perspective on anyone else. Now, I didn't know he had that perspective, but when you look at his life's work shortly after he retired, you get the sense that he is a really introspective guy and was able to use his ability to storytell to touch so many people, no matter what walk of life.
Last question, just as a fan of the game, as most of us are, how will you remember him? I will personally remember him by just being absolutely terrified anytime he had the ball and needed to score, because he was going to do it. That's it.
So there are three anecdotes that I'll remember him by. One is in his documentary, he tours his Achilles, and there's a scene where there's a bunch of little metal balls put in front of him, and he's got to pick them up with his toes and roll them and put them into a little Tupperware container. It's basically to work the muscles around the Achilles that haven't been working while it's been in a cast that might atrophy, and to break up the scar tissue. And he's attacking this little task as if it's game 7 of the NBA Finals. And the level of competition on his face was next level. The other is, you know, Matt Barnes, who later would be a teammate, you know, is trying to inbound the ball, and Kobe standing right in front of him. And he literally, with a basketball, strong human being, Matt Barnes, throws it right inches towards Kobe's face as if he's going to hit him in the face with the ball or throw it in his face. And Kobe doesn't flinch at all. He just stays there looking at him, chewing his gum. And so I'll remember that moment. And yeah, this guy, he's wired different. He's built different. And the last is an interview that he gave on Kimmel, where he was telling a story about people talking to him about, man, you got so many kids, you got so many girls, you need a boy to carry on that legacy. And his daughter says, oh, no, I'm going to carry on that legacy. And Kobe just loving that story, because she was like, no, I'm here too. In her own way, Gianna had the mama mentality. And I'll remember that for how proud he was of telling that story. And also, sadly, think, man, I just can't imagine. There are so many great photos. My IG is full of them. Of the two of them courtside, him so happy with his arm around her.
Coaching her. She coaching him at some points.
Yeah. And even when he scored his 81 and he walks off, you know, him hugging his daughters and his wife. And so to think of him courtside at various games, hugging her, arm around her, laughing, and to think that ostensibly he was going down in a chopper, arm around her, not laughing, it's sadly, that's one of the things I'll think about when I think of him. When I hear that one name, Kobe, that'll be one of the memories that flood to my mind. Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Donovan.
Thank you.
Donovan Bennett of Sportsnet. If you'd like to hear more from Donovan on Kobe and everything else in the NBA, you can find his podcast, Free Association, wherever you get yours. That was The Big Story. For more from us, you know where to go. It's the website, thebigstorypodcast.ca. It is the Twitter account, @thebigstoryfpn. And of course, it is any podcast app, anywhere, Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, you pick. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. We will talk tomorrow.
My name is John Cullen, and I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and curling. It's the story of Broomgate, how a single broom, yes, a broom, turned friends into foes and almost killed the 500-year-old sport of curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
Broomgate, available now.